Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for Thursday, February 6, 2014. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises in Mandeville, Louisiana. Also this half hour, Todd Gleason delves deeply into the commodity title of the new Farm Bill. And Lisa Brotz grabs bowls and bowls of comfort food in her latest edition of Backyard Industry. Also along this afternoon, meteorologist Mike Tenura will have the latest on agricultural weather. It's all on the Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Let's see how futures settled on this Thursday afternoon. Hard red winter May wheat, 637 down 4 1/4. July, 628 and a half down 4 1/2. Soft May wheat, 582 and a quarter down 7. July, 586 down 4 1/4. March corn, 443 down 1/4. July, 453 and a half up 1 1/4. And December, 458 and a half up 1 1/2. March soybeans, 1325 and 3/4 up 9 1/2. July, 1292 and 3/4 up 12. And November, 1118 and a half up 6. March soybean meal, 446 up $4. March soybean oil, 3866 up 43 cents. February live cattle, 139.50 down 20. March feeder cattle, 167.47 and a half up 55. And February lean hogs, 86.30, and they were down 15 cents on the day. And those are today's settlements from the CME Group out of Chicago.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. For over 96 years, generations of farmers have turned to Farm Credit for their financial needs. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit offers products and service geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Lunar's weather highlights, he says that Brazil will see a restricted rainfall pattern through early next week before an increase in shower activity begins Wednesday. Rapid harvest progress will continue through early next week with a slower harvest pace beginning on Wednesday. Meanwhile, increasing levels of crop stress will occur in many areas before rain increases. Greater rain is needed to increase soil moisture for planting of second-season corn and late-season soybeans. We'll also have need for greater rain to protect production. Meanwhile, in Argentina, a band of frequent rain will occur from Cordoba to Entre Rios and northern Buenos Aires during the coming week that will cause some flooding. Some low-lying crops may be impacted.
Support for WILL Agriculture comes from Murray Wise Associates, LLC. Land auctions, farm management, financial services, and institutional and corporate real estate. Information on upcoming land auctions can be found at murraywiseassociates.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Have you purchased your tickets yet for the All-Day Ag Outlook meeting? It's March 4th at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Among those presenting will be Sue Martin of Ag Investment Services. Murray Wise will also give us a presentation on land values for 2014. And Jonathan Kopress, a professor at the U of I, will give us all the ins and outs of the commodity title that President Obama will sign tomorrow. It's all just $30 and includes a continental breakfast and Beef House lunch and 25th anniversary hat. Get your tickets now by calling 217-333-7300. Joining us on the telephone to talk about the markets is Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises, and he is in Mandeville, Louisiana. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi, Dave.
Is the price action that we saw today constructive for would-be corn and soybean bulls?
Well, I think so. There's no exact pattern, but there's a strong tendency for Tuesdays and Thursdays to be consolidation days from a trend. And the trend that we got going for us right now is sideways to higher. So we've had a tendency to have higher Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays, and then we've spent some time consolidating on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Now, like I said, nothing's exact in this business, but that's the general flow of a sideways to higher type market.
Well, certainly targets have been met. March corn 440 was a target. We're over that, 443 on a settlement basis today. March beans 1319 was a target. We're over that on a settlement basis, 1325 and three quarters today. Where can you see these two commodities going in the next few weeks?
Well, I kind of look at the lead futures chart, and I think this push above this 336, 338 area, which was kind of the top end of a lead futures chart, and the bottom end was kind of like 410, 411. Just before the report, everybody panicked. And the market slipped down to like 406. But I kind of view that as kind of like about a 30 cent trading range sideways market. And we're breaking out of that sideways pattern. And what you do is usually add the width of that sideways pattern to the top end of the range. And if you would add, let's say, 30 cents onto 339, you could maybe read an objective up there into the 460s as a longer term objective. You also have some key moving averages starting to take hold here, since we have been basically in a sideways market. Corn futures now are above the 100-day moving average. We've been going sideways basically since end of October. So with the corn market now having clearly broken above the 100-day moving average, it's not going to be long before the 50-day moving average crosses above the 100. So we're going to start bringing in some long-term moving average traders betting on something to come. Basically, this type of action for the technician or for the moving average guy tells you that something good is going to happen to corn on the price side of things, and they're getting in position to take advantage of that.
So how much of this has been, of the run thus far, has been short covering as opposed to new longs entering the marketplace?
Well, when you look at open interest has basically held steady to actually increase. When you get into a situation like that, it tells you that you have new buying coming into the market. You may have some short covering from the bears that were betting on 350 corn going into that January crop report. But for the most part, you've got technicians like me looking at that moving average system, looking at that sideways pattern, looking at it breaking out of a sideways pattern, starting to probe the long side. So you're starting to get some new buying in the market from the technical crowd. The risk the technical crowd runs is it could be a bull trap. We don't know for sure, but you have to go with your system, and your system is telling you for over a week now to basically be long this corn market. I think the driving forces is demand. USA's balance sheet is understating demand by at least 150 million bushels. I think it's understating ethanol demand by 50 million bushels. So when I look at the balance sheet, I think our carryout is closer to 1.4 than it is what the trade was talking about, 2.1, maybe prior to the report. So that's about a 700 million bushel swing in long-term expectations. We've got good feed usage going on with this cold winter weather. I think the demand equation on corn is probably better than expected, and I'm not convinced that we have the supply around that USJ says we have. So I'm kind of looking for I think the corn market is in position now to rally into the planting season, and we'll see what kind of planting season we have.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Very well.
That's Dan Zwicker of CGB Enterprises out of Mandeville, Louisiana, and he joins us every Thursday afternoon right here on the Closing Market Report.
Support comes from the Black Dog Smoke and Ale House, serving barbecue beef brisket, pork shoulder, ribs, chicken, and more. Slow cooked over a wood-fired smoker. Open Sunday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., and Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. The Black Dog, 201 North Broadway in downtown Urbana.
Coming up next, Lisa Brooks talks about our cravings for comfort food in this edition of Backyard Industries.
Compared with recent winters, this has been a splendid one in which to hibernate human style. The words polar vortex have entered our lexicon. We've had enough snow to almost justify the purchase of a pair of snowshoes. And cabin fever led to a change in name for this series to Backyard Industry from In My Backyard. Welcome to my freshly snow-covered world. It's also been a fantastic winter for cooking. I'm not talking strictly about holiday food. Holiday food can be fussy and show-offy and sometimes overly emotional. Like a high-maintenance but beloved relative, it has to be indulged, and it's fun to indulge it. But meals in bowls, especially large ones, which my mom calls Jethro bowls after the big lug of a character from the Beverly Hillbillies, are like favorite aunts or uncles. They're the ones who let the kids have ice cream for dinner and foster easy conversations with everyone. They're comfortable and sustaining and, above all, not difficult.
My comfort food in the wintertime is usually potatoes with some other kind of vegetable in it in a bowl that's warmed up. My parents used to put mashed potatoes with leftovers of anything in the fridge and heat it up in the winter when they didn't feel like cooking. So that usually came out when no one wanted to shovel. Lately, I've been making sweet potatoes with Brussels sprouts with barbecue sauce, which sounds like a disgusting combination, but it is really good.
I didn't realize, though, how much comfort food we'd been eating ourselves this winter until I opened up a cupboard a couple of weeks ago and there wasn't a single clean bowl to be found, Jethro or otherwise. They were all in the sink, more than a dozen of them. They'd served as vessels for meal after meal, meals we'd been literally wrapping our hands around as we found ourselves stunned into the need for food that wasn't just filling, but also warming. Homemade oatmeal, from scratch rice and beans, pasta covered in a quick sauce, stew.
My family will eat anything that's cooked long and slow and is delicious at the end. And the big argument is always what kind of starch will go with it. Will it be rice or roasted potatoes or some delicious mashed potatoes that we can just plop the stew over? And it just makes me happy thinking about it. A stew, I think, is our meal in a bowl for the winter.
Part of our desire for comfort food in the winter is market-driven classical conditioning. As soon as the first pumpkin-flavored whatever hits the shelves in the fall, we want winter food. Part of it is also triggered by encroaching darkness. We want to eat something filling and go to bed. And part of our desire is tradition born out of necessity. In the days before eating fresh produce out of season, we ate warm foods made of roots and tubers and hardy foods that could survive cold temperatures outside or cool temperatures in storage inside. We can eat whatever we want pretty much whenever we want it now, but traditional recipes call for traditional, season-appropriate foods. And there's nothing wrong with that. In the cold months here in central Illinois, eaters can find locally grown potatoes, carrots, squash, and sturdy greens like kale that can be transformed into something hot that goes into a bowl.
So one of my favorite meals when it is cold outside, one bowl, kale, tofu, brown rice with sesame oil, olive oil, garlic, and crushed red pepper. That is super tasty, super easy to make. But for stick to your ribs, one bowl meal, that would be my mom's chicken and dumplings.
After driving home in a recent snowstorm, I took off my coat and surveyed the interior of the refrigerator. I chopped up a couple carrots, some celery, and an onion, threw them into a large pot with a chicken carcass from a couple of nights ago, two bay leaves, a pinch of peppercorns, covered it all with water, and put it on the stove. We may be officially on the back end of winter, but never do we need sustaining food more than in the 6 weeks before spring arrives. I'll take mine in the form of chicken and dumplings this weekend, in a Jethro bowl. Many thanks to my colleagues Donda Beard, Tim Myers, and Lindsay Moon for their contributions to this piece. For Backyard Industry, this is Lisa Braltz.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold and their newest AgriGold Giant 107-day A6408, available for 2014 in Roundup Ready and also VT Triple Pro Rib. More information on A6408, including yield and dry down data, is at AgriGold.com.
The Farm Bill is heading to the President's desk on Friday. It is full of compromises made between the House and the Senate. Todd Gleason spoke with University of Illinois farm policy specialist Jonathan Copress and asked him about the acreage compromises made in the commodities title.
This was a big, big compromise point. The House had been all on planted acres. The Senate had a revenue program on planted acres and the target price program on base acres. And this goes back to the 1996 reforms and the issue of having whether the program is coupled to your production, coupled to your planting decisions, and what that might do to markets. The Midwest, particularly soybeans and corn, producer groups and farmers individually and their members of Congress were adamantly opposed to particularly a fixed price program on the planted acre, which can lead in a low price scenario, can really lead to distortion issues and having farmers, you know, the old saying, be planning for the government payment or planning for the program. So I think, to the extent, it was a compromise. There's quite a few compromises worked out in this bill. I think it was, I think it's important to a lot of farmers in this country that whole plant for the payment situation not come back into effect. So I think that'll help. It does, however, sort of complicate things because now we're putting a revenue program on base, and certainly there's long been a concern about base acres and how adequate they represent the way farming is happening today. But at this point in time, I think they found the best middle ground they could to provide the programs but keep them out of this potentially distortionary setup.
You've mentioned target prices a couple of times. Deal with corn, soybeans, wheat, if you happen to know those.
Yes, yeah, so I think the they're called reference prices this time around. So they've changed the name. The corn reference price, I believe, is at $3.70 a bushel. Wheat, I think, is at $5.50, and soybeans at $8.40. So they've been increased over the 2008 levels. In fact, all the covered commodities have received a reference price increase. That matters most if you select the price loss coverage program, but it also plays into the revenue program. The way they design the calculation for that benchmark in the revenue program incorporates those reference prices. So if you have a year in which prices fall below it, you plug in the reference price.
SCO?
SCO is included. It's in the crop insurance title of the Farm Bill. It has been changed slightly from what passed the House and the Senate. As part of the compromise, part of the ability to, or the efforts to trim spending. And it has been sort of put on the same playing field a little bit, if you will, with the revenue program in Title I. So where SCO and the House and Senate passed bill, your coverage started at 90% revenue. It's county-based, county-level revenue. The SCO program now starts at 86%. So your coverage begins at 86%, gives you the 14-point anyway, so you got a 14-point deductible, and county level, the other piece of that is you cannot have both SCO and ARC. So if you sign up for ARC, you're ineligible for the SCO on that commodity. So there's you can get it with your price loss coverage, but you can't get it. You can't get both that and ARC at the same time.
Oh, wait a second. Well, when you make the decision on ARC, which you're going to have to do this year, apparently, is that a yearly decision or is that a permanent decision?
That's a one-time, irrevocable decision for the life of this farm bill. So for the next five, the decision you make this year, much the same way the acre and countercyclical program decision was in 2009, the decision you make this year will run with that, will be the one you live with for the next 5 years.
Does this mean that FSA has to have the whole matrix for SCO done by the time we get to crop insurance sign up?
Well, so because crop insurance runs differently, the SCO program will not be in place until 2015, the 2015 crop year, because there's no way to put it in place now. So what farmers need to know when they sign up is that if you choose ARC, SCO is not available for you beginning in the 15 crop year and reinsurance year. However, you can get it if you're in the price loss coverage program. So there's a slight difference. Now, the reality is because SCO is a county-based program that starts at 86%, and ARC is you could choose an ARC at county level at 86%. There's not a whole lot of difference there. The biggest difference is that as an insurance program, it's going to be on your planted acres. It's going to use your APH. It's going to use the county, actual county instead of the 5-year Olympic average. And the other big difference is, of course, an insurance program pays on what you plant, whereas the revenue programs are going to be base acres. And for the county level, you're going to get paid on 85% of your base acres. The individual level will be at 65% of your base acres. Another interesting twist, not to get us too confused, the individual farm level is a sum of all the covered commodities on the farm. So instead of commodity by commodity, it actually applies to all the covered commodities on your farm. This is a little bit more like the SURE program operated out of the 2008 bill. So, as I said, there's going to be a series of choices and decision points that farmers are going to have to untangle to know what's going to work best for their operation.
That's University of Illinois Farm Policy Specialist Jonathan Kopress discussing the ARC and PLC programs. Farmers will need to choose one or the other of the programs later this year as their primary safety net. That choice will have an impact on the 2014 crop. It's National Frozen Yogurt Day. It's also St. Dorothy's Day, patron of brewers, gardeners, and florists. On this day in agricultural history in 1617, Prospero Alpini died, an Italian physician and botanist. He is said to have introduced coffee and bananas to Europe and to have been the first to artificially fertilize date palms. In 1864, Frederick Tudor died, an American businessman who, long before the availability of electric refrigerators, created an export trade in block ice, harvested from frozen fresh water ponds in New England during winter and shipped to India, Europe, and the Caribbean in insulated cargo holds and stored in insulated warehouses. In 1685, Charles II, King of England, died. Tea was introduced to England during his reign. As a way of trying to make tea popular, King Charles issued a proclamation suppressing coffee houses in December of 1675. The public response was so negative that he had to revoke it the following month. And in 1796, John Stevens Henslow was born, a British clergyman and botanist. He was a mentor of Charles Darwin. To help get farmers to apply scientific methods, he gave lectures on the fermentation of manure. He also showed Irish farmers how to get starch from rotten potatoes during the potato famine of 1845 and 1846. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at agricultural weather is meteorologist Mike Tenura of T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, for the longest time, Brazil had just about the best possible weather that you could want for soybean development. I mean, there were just like week after week of that. But all of a sudden, the worm has turned, and it seems to have dried out down there.
Yeah, you're exactly right, though we would make a little bit of an argument that parts of Brazil were not always doing all that well, mainly in the southeast region, which accounts for around 20% of Brazil's soil. In late December, it essentially stopped raining in that region. It's also a very important coffee region. And what's occurred is that this big area of high pressure that was suppressing rainfall in that region over the last 4 to 6 weeks has expanded and essentially become stuck across a much larger area of Brazil. So over the last 2 to 3 weeks, most corn and soybean areas, except for the key state of Mato Grosso, turned very dry. So this is a bit of an issue, especially because we can see that for at least one more week, this high remains stuck in place. If it lasts for another, say, 3 to 4 weeks, then all of a sudden you start moving into the dry season where this type of pattern becomes normal. So this is a big issue. It is something that is being followed closely, and the impact of it is yet to be seen.
It's my understanding that maybe mid-next week Brazil might get some relief in the form of precipitation.
Well, far southern areas of Brazil do have a decent chance for rain, starting up around Thursday or Friday. That occurs when a cool front moves northward from Argentina. But it's only one chance for rain because we don't think that it signifies a large pattern change. We think it's just one rain event within a dry pattern. And also, it's very important to note that the key corn and soybean area of Argentina is being hit by big thunderstorm clusters every single day because of this pattern. And that will continue for at least another week. We could see rainfall totals far in excess of 10 to 14 inches for a one-month total in Argentina. This is an area that has rainfall totals similar to what we experience in the Corn Belt in the summer. So we're talking about a lot of rain. Whether it has a big impact on yield or harvesting coming up within a few weeks is very difficult to answer. But this is something that is being followed, and we think it's something worth noting.
Let's turn our attention then to the United States, where just about anybody I've talked to in Illinois says, when will winter end?
Yeah, this has been a brutal winter. There's no doubt about that. On the plus side, we see the core of Arctic air shifting onto the north beginning Saturday and Sunday. So we'll turn a bit warmer as we move into next week. On the minus side, we have high coverage of deep snowpack across the central U.S., and that tends to keep temperatures lower than would otherwise occur if it didn't exist. So even though we have a warmer pattern coming up, we still only see high temperatures topping out in the 20s for most of next week, which is still 5 to 10 degrees below normal.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
That's Mike Tenura of T-Storm Weather in Chicago, Illinois. And that is today's Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey.